that I did with Overa Haroni and Mikum Berkouz, and maybe a little bit of further thoughts that Michal Fabinger and I had on the same subject. Try to use the two transparency machines. So as you know, string theory has many exotic phases that people have gotten interested in recent years. Non-geometrical string backgrounds, non-commutative theories, little string theories, Ohm theory, etc. And sometimes this, you know, quote-unquote exotic phase is actually generic in the sense that in order to get back to more conventional physics, you have to tune a parameter to some special value. So Aharoni and Berkouz and I stumbled across a new exotic phase, which involves gravitational physics, and we labeled it non-local string theory. And it arises, on at least on the gravity side, of ADS-CFT dual pairs, which are deformed by double trace operators. And a priori, just as with the other exotic phases of the theory, it's interesting to study this one to see if it, to see what its features are, see if it helps with outstanding problems in the theory, and so on. So, in fact, I think there are two places where it's starting to look interesting. One of them is what I'll spend most of the time today on, which is that in the framework of these models, we found an explicit example where there's supersymmetry breaking, but the moduli potential is uncorrected. This is, unfortunately, in a very esoteric context of ADS3 times S3 times T4, the deformation of that. So we'd very much like to generalize it, and I probably won't have anything definitive to say about that, but anyway, this is one further reason to, one more specific reason why I'm interested, and also for a very general reason that I'll explain, it seems that these kinds of world sheet theories arise naturally in describing these states, such as the ones that arise when you have particle production processes in time backgrounds. Okay. So I'm going to start by briefly going over the basic description of these theories as they arise in ADS-CFT, and then I'll go on to the specific supersymmetry breaking model for the rest of the time. So the idea, again, is to take the Lagrangian of the field theory side of ADS-CFT and consider what it means to, on the gravity side, to add to this Lagrangian a double trace operator, that is an operator which is a composite operator that is a product of two individual single trace operators, each of which would individually correspond to an ordinary gravity field on the gravity side of ADS-CFT. With the scaling that I've indicated, in terms of operators which themselves are normalized to give correlation functions that begin at order n squared, as in the usual Tuft expansion, this contribution also leads to effects on the theory at leading order, order n squared, in the large n expansion, as you can see by considering the effect of this deformation perturbatively on any correlation function. So say we look at a correlation function of J operators. In perturbation theory, in the coefficient of the double trace deformation, that's given by the original answer in the undeformed theory, plus at order H tilde, a contribution that comes from inserting a power of this deformation into the correlation function. And at leading order, this contribution factorizes into a correlation function in which one of the factors in the double trace couples to some number of the original fields in the correlation function times the rest, coupled to the second operator in the double trace. And of course, then we sum over all the partitions. And this, because we have a 1 over n squared out front, and each of these correlation functions scales like n squared, the resulting term still scales like n squared and affects the theory at leading order in n. And if we're satisfied, as I'll do for most of the talk today, in working theory in H tilde, then, of course, each of these contributions boils down to something we can evaluate in the unperturbed theory. And we can then, in order to understand what this means on the gravity side, use the usual ADS-CFT dictionary to describe it on the gravity side. So the same thing that we have over here on the field theory side is described on the gravity side by the corresponding Feynman diagram coupling the J gravity fields phi 1 through phi j corresponding to the field theory operators O1 through OJ. So we get a contribution from the original unperturbed correlation function that's just this, plus partitions into sub-Feynman diagrams describing these correlation functions in the order H tilde contribution. So the effect of adding the double trace term is to introduce an extra infinite sequence of diagrams at each order in N, or on the gravity side, at each order in G string, which involves adding this extra vertex, which can connect otherwise disconnected Feynman diagrams or Riemann surfaces in the string language. So in string theory, this is precisely effected by shifting the world sheet action by something bilocal in the corresponding vertex operators. So this looks more complicated than it is. This is just basically this vertex written in terms of the two vertex operators that correspond to phi 1 and phi 2. So this just, by construction, reproduces this perturbation expansion, which is the direct translation using the unperturbed ADS-CFT dictionary of this deformation. So it looks kind of funny. I mean, it's a pretty radical thing to do in the sense that on the world sheet we've introduced something that's blatantly non-local. I should mention something similar was found by Moshe and his friends in studying deep brain recoil, and we don't understand the relation to that, but it would be interesting to see if there is one.
So if you have the double trace operator, like say a function of the
Then it would, this would be that function of these of these integrated vertex operators.
I mean, that sounds very cool. What is sort of the hot evidence that this theory works?
Well, it's just, this much is really not a conjecture. This is just this precisely reproduces the shift in the correlation functions. I'll give you a very specific example where we do these computations in detail later in the talk, but at this level, I don't think there's really any conjecture here. There's no new conjecture. Yeah, there's the ADS-CFT conjecture, which... I mean, there are lots of, open questions about what this all means, but so far what I've said I think is mathematically trivial. So
none of these operators have protective dimensions, some of them have.
Well, okay, so it depends on which example you study. This becomes most interesting if you consider a deformation on the field theory side, which is by a relevant or a marginal operator, so that it has a right to affect the bulk of the space on the gravity side. And indeed, we do have examples where that's the case and where, in some cases, supersymmetry is preserved. Our original example involved an exactly marginal supersymmetry preserving deformation of a particular conformal field theory. The one I'll do today breaks supersymmetry, but as you'll see, we have control over that. So this is kind of independent of supersymmetry or not supersymmetry. Okay, so we're left to this new diagram string perturbation theory in the sense that we now have this extra expansion in H tilde to do. So just to belabor this a little bit more, let me just make it clear what's being said about the diagram. So if I look at the effect of this deformation on the world sheet action and work again on the space of disconnected Riemann surfaces, allowing them to be connected by the double trace vertex, then if we look at order H tilde, for example, at order 1 over G string squared, leading order in N, we have this contribution where you join a pair of spheres correcting the original genus zero amplitude. At one loop order, you have the torus plus an order H tilde, the torus connected to a sphere, and also a torus effectively made out of the double trace going to the boundary, and so on and so forth. So this is kind of interesting because at a given genus, the usual rules of, you know, this is a very specific framework, but for example, at genus 1, you'll not have a modular invariant contribution for the full amplitude. I mean, this torus will, of course, still preserve modular invariance, but this diagram has nothing to do with modular forms and so on. So the kinds of contributions you'll get at a given order will be different, and issues like supersymmetry cancellations and so on can therefore work out differently. So this is what we have on the world sheet, and I just want to explain how this goes along with other things that we know. If you go back to the original Tuft idea of how large N-gauge theories should morph into string theories as you take the Tuft coupling large, this is consistent with that. If we have a double trace vertex such as the one I've drawn here, then you know each one of the single trace parts of this vertex can fill out into its own Riemann surface, leading to diagrams where you have connected two Riemann surfaces by this double trace vertex. And this is all consistent with all the symmetries of the problem. World sheet conformal invariance works out because of the fact that in our case, the vertex is really inserted at the boundary. It's not as though you're inserting some sort of space-time delta function. And it agrees with this picture precisely when you take these points to the boundary so that you get back a contact interaction in four dimensions, which is all that a Tuft would have predicted. And in the full 10 dimensions, it gets sort of smoothed out into this picture. Also, as a comment, there's been some interest recently in a particular limit of ADS backgrounds, these PP wave backgrounds. And if you look at the string theory that's derived from the field theory in this limit, you find again that when the gauge theory has double trace interactions, the corresponding string theory has non-local interactions in its Hamiltonian. So this seems to be what's going on from all points of view. There is a simplification, though, that's important. If you just restrict yourself to classical gravity in the ADS directions, so you ignore the Einstein space, then there was an important observation made by these folks that, you know, is kind of clear if you just think for a minute about these diagrams, that this deformation in these limits simply corresponds to a change in the boundary condition, which is enforced by a particular boundary action. So that can be useful in certain circumstances. It's worth emphasizing, though, that the effects of this still propagate to the bulk of the space, because the space is effectively sort of a finite box. And in particular, we again have examples which involve marginal or relevant deformations on the field theory side, which then affect the low energy physics of the field theory and therefore the region away from the boundary on the gravity side. And also, it's worth emphasizing that this prescription is not realized locally in 10 dimensions, although it is a local boundary condition in the ADS dimensions.
Bulk physics,
yeah.
You mean it affects the local bulk, the bulk physics by propagation in from the boundary, not so much that it affects the equation of motion of the supergravity bulk.
Right, so the supergravity.
It affects the background.
It affects the background, right. Right.
Right. Good.
Right. Yeah.
Coming back to the question before, I mean, there's somehow two interpretations of this picture you have. I mean, one, you can say that indeed it's two spheres stuck which has happened on one point, but you could also say it's a single sphere which does that as a pinch. So in the second picture,
okay,
it's
good.
Less clear that you really need a non-local string description. You could also, it could also be that.
Okay, so let me say something that might help there. One way of saying why I don't think that's right is the following. If you take one of these backgrounds, which has a, say, an exactly marginal double trace deformation, then we need a deformation of the world sheet theory, which describes that, the result of doing that deformation. Now, every ordinary marginal deformation of the world sheet CFT has already been accounted for. So the thing that we're getting here cannot arise by taking the world sheet action and adding some ordinary local 1-1 vertex operator to it. Those all have to do with single trace deformations. So this is something else. I think it'd be great if someone could find a more conventional description of it. But
I'm skeptical because I remember from the old matrix models. There was this business about, these kind of interactions were also put into the old matrix model. And then in the end, Lebanon gave some funny interpretation of these kind of touching interactions in the old matrix model by just saying that you could still use the local description by new rule, but that you had somehow used this funny second branch of new theory, and then you could account for all the.
Yeah, that was a very different case, though, because, as you say, it was sort of there were two possibilities. Here there's a whole family of possibilities that you have to account for. So, again, if I start from the original background, I cannot get this by adding a 1-1 vertex operator to the world sheet Lagrangian. Okay. So the physics that results from this deformation is non-local in 10 dimensions and on the world sheet. So you might just take this as sort of the opposite way I'm taking it. I'm taking it as an opportunity to learn about a new phase of string theory. You could also just conclude that this is a counterexample to the idea that any gauge theory, any large n gauge theory, should have a gravity dual. Here, it does in some sense, but it's not a standard local gravity or supergravity theory in 10 dimensions. I'm going to continue thinking more positively about it and thinking of it as an opportunity to find a new class of backgrounds.
It is local in 5 dimensions.
Well, at least at leading order it is. I don't know if the non-locality in 10 dimensions can somehow propagate into the 5 dimensions. I don't have any evidence that it does propagate into the 5 dimensions. What we know for sure, of course, is that it's local at the boundary, that it corresponds to a local boundary field theory. And that's
still entirely consistent that conformal field theories generally are equivalent to gauge theories.
Yeah. Right, although, again, I think it's important to remember that the sphere is huge, so.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. I think that, yeah, I agree with that statement. And another sort of mitigating factor is the following. Although I emphasize that this deformation affects the theory at leading order in n, different sectors of the theory are affected at different orders in n, so there are. fields which don't see the deformation at leading order in n. For example, if you do exclusive graviton scattering along the ADS directions, it's unaffected at tree level, namely at order n squared. You can see that from the diagrams as follows. Any large n diagram would just be a connected set of spheres, connected again by the double trace wedge, which involves a bilocal product of some matter fields in the theory. So exclusive graviton scattering would involve sub-diagrams, which are spheres with some number of gravitons coming in, trying to scatter into a single, at least there are some sub-diagrams which just have a single matter field on them, and that just isn't a coupling in the classical theory. You couple to the stress energy, which is quadratic in the matter fields. You don't couple to a single one. So this is zero, and you can also see that in the field theory by noting that the expectation value of an operator or its descendants is zero. Okay, so you know some of the physics is normal. There's a chance that you could have a sector of the theory that sees ordinary physics and other sectors that see this odd physics at leading n. Okay, so now I want to get to the example I wanted to cover today. This is a example arising as a deformation of ADS3 times S3 times T4, which, as you know, is one of the basic examples of ADS-CFT duality, arising from the near horizon limit of Q5 and S5 brains and Q1 fundamental strings. If you look at the field theory side, you get a two-dimensional 4-4 superconformal field theory with a central charge that's proportional to Q1 times Q5. On the gravity side, you have the space I mentioned with the six-dimensional string coupling being given by basically squared being given by 1 over Q1 and that radius of ADS being given by Q5, the square root of Q5. There's a symmetry that'll be important for us. There are lots of symmetries, but in particular there's an SU2 times SU2R symmetry of the model, which comes from rotations of the sphere on the gravity side and from the superconformal algebra on the field theory side. So what I want to do is take a U1 current out of one of the SU2s, call it J of X, bosonize it in terms of a boson, so write it as D of a free boson, normalized this way, and one from the SU2 right, which I'll call J tilde, bosonized similarly. These are dual, or just in ordinary terms on the gravity side, these are gauge fields. And what I want to do is add a double trace deformation of the theory, which on the field theory side is just some H tilde divided by Q1. Q1 is playing the role of n squared here, JJ tilde. So this being just proportional to D eta, D bar, eta tilde, it's exactly marginal. Up to some contact term issues, it's the same thing you would get if you just change the radius of a free boson in a circle target space of string theory. Here, I'm talking about the boundary theory, but same two-dimensional field theory statement. So this is exactly marginal. But since we're talking about the R symmetry here, this deformation breaks supersymmetry. So I just said that it's exactly marginal, but it breaks supersymmetry. The fact that it's marginal means it preserves conformal invariance, which means it preserves the ADS3 isometries. And in particular, that means that we didn't generate any tadpoles for the moduli fields of the theory. If we had, then they would have been forced to vary over the ADS3, ruining the ADS3 isometries, and we would not have preserved conformal invariance. So although we broke supersymmetry, we did it in such a way that we did not generate a destabilizing potential for moduli. This is something that Katru and I were interested in sort of early on in ADS-CFT. We found models where this happened at leading order in the large n approximation by doing some simple orbifolds. And here for the first time in this, again, rather simple and esoteric context, we find an example that's true that has this feature for finite n. It's just exact. Now, because this deformation involves these simple currents, J and J tilde, we can calculate much of the effect of this explicitly on both sides of the correspondence. In the CFT, as was worked out in early days of two-dimensional CFT, any operator in the theory with charges Q and Q tilde under these two U1s can be written in terms of the free bosons I introduced by an exponential in eta because of the normalizations. There's a 1 over root Q1, Q5 in my definition of the charges here, but basically it's e to the charge times eta and similarly for eta tilde times some polynomial in derivatives of eta and eta tilde times some operator that's independent of eta and eta tilde, so that if you calculate the OPE of J with this operator, then it just pulls out the charge. So using this, we can calculate explicitly many things that we'd like to understand about this model, like how those correlation functions change in this model. So, so for example, if we wanted to look at the two-point function of some charged operator, let's just take a pure exponential to be simple, then we can do it in the way I indicated in general terms at the beginning of the talk, by just pulling down factors of the deformation and working out the correlation functions. So if you work this out, you see that it starts out at order h tilde times g string to the zero, so it's coming at order appropriate for a torus diagram, and it corresponds to this kind of diagram in space-time. And if you work it out, then you get this result in terms of a ultraviolet cutoff in the boundary theory, where I haven't let points get closer than A to each other. So this is a very standard thing in conformal perturbation theory about some conformal field theory. One obtains this kind of divergence that can then be absorbed in the operators. So we can renormalize the operators as I've indicated here. And then the rest of this is just encoding a shift in the dimension of y. This is a two-point function, so it's calculating the dimension of the operator. And the shift in the dimension is, so left and right moving dimensions are what I've indicated here. So they depend on the R charges, which means that they split different elements of the supermultiplets. And they grow with mass, so that's sort of officially hard supersymmetry breaking, explicit supersymmetry breaking. On the other hand, for small h tilde in the perturbative regime, the corrections are very, very small. On the other hand, we can take h tilde as big as we want according to the general argument about the exact marginality of the operator. So, what we'd like to then do is understand how this manages to occur on the gravity side of the correspondence, both to explore this exotic phase and also to understand this supersymmetry breaking effect, this non-renormalization of the moduli potential. So we can study the gravity side quite explicitly using the vertex operators corresponding to these currents that were introduced by Kutusov and Seiberg. They're written semi-classically in terms of, so let me use a metric for three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space that I've written up there. The radial coordinate is phi. And in terms of those coordinates, we can write down the vertex operators for J and J tilde in terms of these functions lambda that solve the Laplace equation with appropriate boundary conditions in this background. And anyway, you get this relatively simple form for the vertex operators, where the left movers on the world sheet, as usual, in this vertex operator have the corresponding world sheet current corresponding to the U1 symmetry that we're talking about. So this is just a gauge boson vertex operator in ADS3. Formally, it's a total derivative, so if everything's smooth, you can see you can just write this thing as a total z-bar derivative, and we'll use that fact in our analysis. So in this model, once we know these vertex operators, we can write down the shift in the world sheet action explicitly in terms of them. And this is what you get. And again, of course, since these are integrated vertex operators, it's non-local on the world sheet, and this integral over x is the usual fact that it comes from a deformation integrated over the field theory space. So using the technology that was developed for ADS3 by these guys and others, we can study this deformation very explicitly on the gravity side as well as on the field theory side. Basically, these operators allow us to just recover anything that falls from the current algebra on the field theory side immediately. And we can, you know, make sure we understand certain technical things like the regularization of divergences and so on in this theory directly on the gravity side again. So just to reiterate, if we were in the supergravity limit, what I would have said about the deformation is that it's generated by a boundary term in the ADS free supergravity that takes this form in terms of the Chern-Simons gauge fields. And we can think about this part, this term, if we like, as a contribution to the interaction Lagrangian of the theory, which introduces a new vertex at the boundary of space that just reproduces the perturbation expansion that I've been discussing. And, of course, as I said, it's been realized that such a boundary term is quite general in these multi-trace situations. So I'm going to continue to use the string theory because we might as well, given that we have not just the supergravity but the string theory worked out. So what I'm going to do is discuss contributions that we get from just the closed string sector and then from the D-brain sector, and discuss the cancellation of the moduli potential in the closed string sector, and at least at sort of the order we understand it in the non-perturbative sector. So let me start by considering closed string diagrams. If we do this in Euclidean space, which is not really what we want, but just to warm up, then because these operators are formally total derivatives, they localize to boundaries of the world sheet, which in just the closed string sector involve points at the boundary of spacetime as well, because if you look at the semi-classical form of the world sheet in ADS 3, as worked out by Oguri and friends, it looks like this, and the vertex operators are really inserted at the boundary. So for Euclidean closed strings, you get contributions that reproduce the shifts in dimensions, but in some sense these contributions are localized at the boundaries. In Lorentzian space, that's not the case, but anyway, here it is. And using this technology, we can reiterate how to absorb the divergences you see in this perturbation expansion directly on the gravity side, which is, again, important if we want to be able to study this kind of phase directly without always appealing to the field theory. So that works by taking this semi-classical form for the world sheet and translating the cutoff in the UV cutoff in the field theory in terms of an infrared cutoff on the gravity side, which means that we cut off this world sheet at some finite point away from the boundary. And as you can see, that in turn translates again into a UV cutoff on the world sheet. So working out this amplitude in terms of the vertex operators on the world sheet, plugging in for the form of the currents, and working out the corresponding amplitude, you find, of course, the same divergence that you found on the field theory side. In terms of gravity side cutoffs, and again, this needs to be rescaled. This needs to be absorbed in a rescaling of the vertex operators. So we can understand this technically how to do this deformation on both sides. So at the level of closed string diagrams, whether they're localized to the boundary or not, it's interesting and somewhat surprising, perhaps, that the moduli potential cancels exactly. So here's how we think about that a little more directly on the gravity side in terms of the diagrams that I've been talking about. So a perturbative contribution to the vacuum energy, or more precisely the moduli potential in this theory, is given by some set of Riemann surfaces joined to each other by the double trace wedges with some number of insertions of moduli fields. So the moduli fields in the boundary CFT are integrated 1-1 operators. And ordinary single trace moduli don't have any dependence on J and J tilde or eta and eta tilde, the U1 sector of the theory. So when we go to compute a subdiagram like this Riemann surface I've written here, these correlators, which involve some number of insertions of J and J tilde from these green lines and some number of insertions of moduli fields, factorize into the part involving the currents and the part totally independent of the currents. And again, this is evaluated in the original theory. And since the moduli potential in the original theory vanishes, so does this. Again, this had to work just from the exact marginality of the deformation, but this is a bit more of a sort of microscopic view of how that happens. Okay, so now I'd like to calculate something a little more interesting for you, something that doesn't cancel and that exhibits some of the physics of these theories. So here's something that we can still can calculate using this Euclidean technology. Namely, we can consider, say, the effect of the deformation on forces between D-brains. So these vertex operators, again, localized to boundaries of the world sheet. In the closed string sector, that meant vertex operators in Euclidean space inserted at the boundary. But, of course, in the open string sector, you can have D-brains, which introduce boundaries to the world sheet, which are squarely in the bulk of ADS. So let's consider, say, a very large ADS and approximately localized D0 brains or D-1 brains, which I'll place at separated positions, phi1 and phi2, in the radial direction of ADS3. And also I'll make them separated on the S3 in both of the directions corresponding to the two U1 isometries that are involved in the double trace deformation. So that's what I'm indicating by this theta and theta tilde. So we can calculate this quite explicitly using the localization of the vertex operators to the boundaries of the world sheet. And that just pulls out a factor of lambda times the integral of k over the boundary, which pulls out the charge for each boundary. And since we have an insertion of k and k tilde, we get a contribution like that summed over each possible pair of boundaries. And this is just on top of the original annulus amplitude, which I'll denote by G0. And the thing that we need to keep track of in this G0 is the fact that since we separated these D-brains on the sphere, we broke the U1 symmetries, and in particular, there's wave function factors e to the q theta and q tilde theta coming from this amplitude. So at this point, we're looking at the sector of this diagram where closed strings of charge q and q tilde propagate in the closed string channel. Okay, so semi-classically, which I think is a good approximation when we're talking about zero brains or minus one brains, we can, first of all, we can use charge conservation to simplify the Q dependence here, and for any particular Q going through the diagram, we can insert the semi-classical expression for those functions lambda that I had and do the integral, and this is what you get for the force for fixed Q and Q tilde. So in order to get the actual potential or force, we need to sum over the possible charges that can propagate in this channel. And because of the fact that this G0 depends on Q non-trivially from these factors here, this generically turns out non-zero. And because Q and Q tilde, again, are R charges, this breaks supersymmetry. It violates the usual relations between Ramond and NS fields propagating in that channel. Okay, so this seems to be a bona fide not supersymmetry-breaking bulk effect that we've exhibited by doing this deformation. And as I say, it's generally non-zero, and it has this explicit form. So, given that, of course, we now want to go back and ask, how did the moduli potential manage to cancel in the D-brain sector? In other words, in terms of contributions that could have come that are exponentially suppressed in G-string from pair creation of D-brains or just D-instanton effects. And we don't understand this in general in detail, but something nice happens at order H tilde that gives a simple cancellation of that order, which is that to translate this result into a instanton computation, of course, you have to do a further step, which is to integrate over the collective coordinates of these brains, which is integrating over theta and theta tilde, and that gives us zero because of these wave function factors. So at the level of the moduli potential, these things don't contribute. As I say, we don't know in any detail how it works at higher orders in H tilde, but again, there is a quite simple, there's this simple fact that it's exactly marginal. Okay, so we'd very much like to be able to generalize this mechanism for breaking supersymmetry without generating the moduli potential, and I could tell you some ideas about that, but none of them are solid yet, so maybe I won't. But you could ask about, just in general, independent of the supersymmetry breaking, whether this is just a sort of exotic thing about ADS-DFT or whether it arises more generally. And I don't know if it's particularly useful, but it does seem that this kind of world sheet structure is going to emerge more generally in a natural way in, say, cosmology. This deformation that we're doing is kind of reminiscent of squeezed states. So a squeezed state is basically just some general Gaussian state, such as the one I've written here, e to the a dagger squared in terms of creation operators. And you can have this with summed over modes with whatever coefficient for the modes that you want. And to the extent that string vertex operators kind of act like creation operators for string, our deformation sort of looks like it's trying to create such a state, since also we, in addition to shifting the action, we're working on the space of disconnected Riemann surface, which is to say we're working on the space of multi-string states, ultimately. So I can say this a bit more precisely than that. So the basic idea here is simply to take this point of view that this kind of theory is in some sense just the result of changing the boundary conditions. And instead of thinking of boundary conditions on time-like boundaries of space, think about boundary conditions on time, which is to say consider transition amplitudes between non-trivial states in the past and future. So just to remind you of something very remedial, if you consider quantum field theory, path integrals between such non-trivial wave functions, you can proceed as follows. So first let's consider a path integral in a field theory, a scalar field theory, between some initial eigenstate of the field phi A and some final eigenstate phi B. That's in the path integral language given by an integral over a path integral with the corresponding boundary conditions. At t equals 0, you have phi equals phi A, and t equals plus infinity, or whatever your final time is, t equals phi B, or phi equals phi B. And if you don't want to do this, and instead you want to compute matrix elements with more general wave functions of phi, then you can do that by just expanding them in terms of the eigenstates. And this transition amplitude is then given by this one with the insertion of the corresponding wave functions. And if those wave functions are something like simple Gaussians that are exponentiated, some e to the w, say, then we can put that the effect of that into the action into boundary terms that are inserted on the past boundary and the future boundary of the region that you're doing the path integral over. So this is just general field theories. So in our case, so the question here is in some sense a pretty prosaic question of how would you describe this amplitude in perturbative string theory if you were interested in doing that. Well, now we've got it down to a deformation of the original theory by some extra interactions. Let me just think of these terms, these boundary terms that came from the non-trivial wave functions as interactions. And so that we've got a new set of diagrams with an extra interaction vertex, say at the initial slice, and summed over all possible insertions of such vertices here and here corresponding to these states. Well, in perturbative string theory, that is reproduced again by a shift in the world sheet action by the corresponding functions of integrated world sheet vertex operators. Doing this will precisely reproduce these contributions to the amplitude. So if you want to calculate directly transition amplitudes between squeezed states, or say between an initial vacuum state and a final squeezed state in a context where such a squeezed state is generated by particle creation, then you know this is how you do it in string theory. So I don't have time to discuss this today, but these people and I are trying to do this explicitly in a specific example. And of course, we found that it's hard to find explicit examples where you can do these calculations because of singularities and other problems that arise just finding interesting cosmology solutions in string theory. But now we think we have some interesting backgrounds that are basically generalizations of the Witten bubble background that we can use to study these things. So that's in progress. And I won't really be able to explain that to you here. And this is also related to some of the ways that we're trying to generalize the supersymmetry breaking mechanism. We're trying to think about what the effect of putting a supersymmetric theory in a non-supersymmetric squeeze state is. And again, using some of these techniques. So I guess I'll stop there and ask for questions.
So I guess it's not clear to me how much your mechanism is relying on the fact that you have conformal symmetry. So that's forbidding quite a bit.
Okay, it's not having conformal symmetry, for example, at the leading order in n, is not enough to guarantee that it will persist at finite n. And that's the usual statement that on the gravity side, if I have a classical background with some isometries, say ADS isometries or Poincaré symmetries or whatever, that doesn't preclude generating a cosmological term which ruins them. So you can have a spontaneous breaking of that symmetry, and that symmetry doesn't guarantee anything. Here, it's really just a specific example where we could exhibit that there was this exactly marginal direction that's valid at finite n.
So
that's important. So
there's no way to isolate the mechanism?
Well, I think...
Is 1 plus 1 dimensions perhaps special in that respect?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, so it's special in that we have enough control to tell when something is exactly marginal, and the fact that these currents have dimension 1 can add up to dimension 1.
At least classically, any potential V of 5 would break conformal invariance. Whereas that's not true in higher dimensions. 5 to the 4th, at least classically, is a conformal invariant. But any function of phi will break conformal invariance in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So I'm just wondering if there's a special statement in 1 plus 1 dimensions that...
Well, I think it's kind of the converse of that statement. I think what we're using here is the fact that in 1 plus 1 dimensions, currents whose dimensions are protected by symmetry, not conformal symmetry, but just the symmetry that they correspond to have dimension 1, so you can put them together to get a marginal operator. That is not true in higher dimensions.
It seems like what you were saying suggests more that it's easier to find such things in higher dimensions. You can look at some 5-4 coupling and hope that it preserves conformal invariance in higher dimensions, whereas in 2 dimensions, you say it obviously wouldn't. But I think we're using the currents here. So it remains true that if you can find in a higher dimensional theory an exactly marginal supersymmetry breaking deformation that's valid at finite end, then that would be another example of this mechanism in that sense.
Yeah, no, I'm worried that's actually unlikely to happen.
Well, sure, I mean, it's but it, I mean, there are other aspects to this beyond that. There's the fact that this is double trace deformation that it involves as essentially a squeeze state of currents, and I can tell you what we're doing to try and generalize it. I don't think it's clear either way.
Yeah.
Indeed, it is not immediately generalizable to higher dimensions. Although I should say that it might be actually that even this example is. I mean, it's a question of whether you want to think of ADS 3 times S3 as 3-dimensional or 6-dimensional. And in this context, of course, we're deforming it, so it could be effectively anything in between 3 and 6. And I'm not really sure what happens when you crank H tilde up very large, which is what gives you the large splittings, I'm not exactly sure what happens to the geometry when you do that, but it's not obviously just 3-dimensional. It could be some, no doubt it's some, you know, very skewed, unrealistic thing, but it's not clearly just 3-dimensional either.
I have another question, which is, can you turn this around and say that this is a way of getting things that are sort of almost conformal, so that you can generate, say, an infrared frame analog?
Yeah, I think in 2 dimensions you would probably be able to find a lot of
things that are almost conformal.
Well, it depends how you're trying to generalize it. Taking currents in higher dimensions gives you something irrelevant rather than something almost marginally relevant. Right. But I think you could find very concrete toy models in ADS3 of that kind of thing using 2-dimensional conformal field theory, because we do have, you know, large discrete families of examples with you know, dimensions of operators that are
but in higher dimensions you have no idea what these operators
are. In higher dimensions, of course, we know much less about conformal field theory, so I think you could use this as a nice little toy example if you wanted to.
In your gravity approximation, you effectively have a scalar field with strange boundary conditions in ADS,
right.
Capital gravity.
Well, here it's a gauge field, but yeah.
Okay, but if you take the scalar field, then Ferrati showed that whenever you have a situation where scalar field is strange boundary conditions, even for a free scalar field, then by doing scalar loops, you effectively pick up a mass term for the graviton. So this will happen in your examples all over the place. Do you have any interpretation for this?
I think that's unlikely here because
if you preserve
conformal invariance, then you have that corresponds.
It doesn't break the ADS isomerism. Yeah. You do ADS, you put a free scalar field. I mean, the calculation needed is for a free scalar field on ADS. Mm-hmm. Give the scalar field anything but the usual boundary condition, which is something which you want to preserve. Then integrate out the free scalar field through loops where you only have scalar fields running the loops where you neglect gravity loops.
Okay, so you're saying
something.
What confused me about this is I understood a massless graviton better be what corresponds to the field theory stress sensor. You haven't changed the field theory stress sensor. I mean,
and
we haven't changed the fact that we have a conformal field theory.
You do it boundary terms to the stress tensor as well.
You say that can correspond to a mass for the graviton. Yeah, I don't know. I just
have
not thought about
that.
I'm sure it works in 2 dimensions.
The double trace deformation does the same thing in higher dimensions.
Well, it doesn't work in higher dimensions.
It does in the supersymmetric example. The 80s high thing. In your first paper, you double trace deformation. So they never not fit in the second.
Yeah, then you definitely.
whatever you're getting is the dual of this field theory.
Yes, so I just wonder if it's matched up with anything.
So this would be coming in loop order, so this would not be coming in
the loop. Yeah, the loop of a scalar field. It's not just, it's not classically gravity, but you have to do the loops
and scalar.
And
it's a non-local operator that induces, it's not a master field theory, it's a non-local operator. It's like box over box at the end of the day, so it induces a mouse. It's like a fine mouse.
Okay, and that's interesting. But at leading edge, you just get the same proton scattering you always got. So. Okay, then that's an interesting point.
Thank you all for coming.